of items for the audience. We have scheduled House Bill 2025 for invited testimony only for about 40 minutes. And my intention is to let the proponents of the bill go first for about 20 minutes, and then let the opponents of the bill go first for about 20 minutes. There's a few elected officials, and perhaps Representative Jensen is one of them, I'm not sure, who would like to speak on the bill, and I'm going to make sure that they have an opportunity to speak on the bill. Before we do that, though, I would like just to also discuss some of the other items on our agenda. Senate Bill 542, Senate Bill 740, and Senate Bill 659, we may pass out today, depending on if I get Senator Shields here and Senator Courtney here, the Senate President, to come down and help vote them out. That would happen sometime around 7:45 or so. I mean, 3:45. So my is what I'd like to do is have an introduction of those the amendments from our committee administrator, just so people know where we're going. But we would not vote on those bills immediately. So let's take about 3 minutes and do that. Then we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2025. So if you could go ahead and let's start with Senate Bill 740. I'd also like to give a warm welcome to Senator Shields for joining us again. Frank, glad you're here very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've got a couple different bills here to talk about. Senate Bill 740 we heard a couple of times last month. This is the e-waste bill, as it's often referred to. It does a number of things, including establishing the electronic product stewardship account. It establishes a fee schedule, which are placed on purchases of a number of electronic devices. And this money is used to manage and fund a recycling program for those devices. The amendment that should be in your packet is the -2 amendment, which I believe is the current, the most current version. As I look around the room here.
And the -2 amendment, that will have a Ways and Means referral?
Yes, the -2, the bill itself has a Ways and Means referral, and the -2 doesn't change that. It's the -2 amendment is pretty technical, doesn't change fundamentally what the bill does. The other two bills that you mentioned, Senate Bill 542 is the Environmental Justice Bill sponsored by Senator Gordley. We also had a hearing on this last month. The -1 amendments to this bill make one significant change, which is they delete Section 4, Sub 4, which is near the bottom of page 2. That's the requirement that each affected agency create a citizen advocate position. The bill in its printed form had a Ways and Means referral, essentially because each impacted agency would require the addition of one FTE to conform to the bill. This gets rid of that, so Legislative Fiscal has given us a no revenue impact statement on the -1 amendments. So I believe the intention is, if the -1 amendments are adopted, to pass the bill straight to the floor. And the third bill, Senate Bill 659, we also heard last month, that's related to the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. The printed version of the bill would have abolished the portion of the forest products harvest tax that's dedicated to funding OFRI. The -1 amendments, which you should have before you, are a gut and stuff, which instead of affecting the revenue source, it makes OFRI subject to an expenditures limitation by the Ways and Means Committee. The amendments contain a blank right now. So we'd be passing this bill to Ways and Means, and it would be up to Ways and Means to decide what that expenditure limitation would be.
Okay. Senator Beyer, do you have any questions on any of those for the
administration? No, not right now.
Okay. Senator Shields, do you have any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2025. And first, Representative Jensen, are you here for 2025? That's a nod, yes. Why don't you come up, Representative Anderson, come up, and would you like to join him, Representative Greenlight? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. Thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you for the opportunity to come and say a few words with you. I'm going to be very short and very brief because there are people that are far more knowledgeable than a country boy from Eastern Oregon on a topic of this nature. This is a bill that that we heard in the House Water Committee, and therefore probably is a kind of logical place for it to come from here. We had extensive testimony that was taken on it, and it ultimately was the conclusion of the committee, the prevailing vote of the committee to move it out, and it moved through the House. And we are delighted that, Mr. Chairman, that you are hearing the bill. I think it's one of the most important health bills that we will be hearing this in this body this session. And I'd like to pass it on then to Representative Anderson and let him make a few comments since he comes to this with some professional expertise as well as with his position as a state legislator. And excuse me, for the record, I am State Representative Bob Jensen from House District 58. It happens to be the Pendleton, Hermiston, Umatilla County area of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I am State Representative Gordon Anderson from District 3, and that's Josephine County, one of the poorest counties in our state. I'm here today as a dentist who spent 37 years looking at damaged teeth and treating them, and also as a practical legislator who knows a good deal when he sees one. This bill, House Bill 2025, is a good deal for the people of Oregon and especially for the children of Oregon. It could save millions of dollars and countless mouths and the health therein. Many of our children have dental care, but 50% of them still have decay, and 25% of those are untreated. And the children that need it most are the ones that this bill will deal with. The children in school-based food programs who don't have the help at home to be able to get dental care. And decay is more common in children of color and non-English speaking homes than it is in those of our homes. These are the children who are unlikely to get protection, except through water supply. Yes, fluorides can be painted on the teeth or taken by tablet, but unless it's broadly based, these children will never get help to protect their teeth. Fluoride is safe. There are 360 million people in 60 countries who are covered with fluoride in the water. 10,000 communities and 145 million people in America are already covered. In fact, we drink fluoridated water here in the city of Salem. And as I think you can tell, there are no detrimental benefits, detriments. This fluoridation is endorsed by the American Dental Association, the American Medical Association, the World Health Organization, Center for Disease Control, and over 100 national and international organizations. But I think the most important thing, when we heard ex-Surgeon General David Satcher here several weeks ago, he indicated that he was just one of a line of Surgeon Generals from the 50s who are strongly in support of fluoridation of our water. Josephine County is a very poor county, and we definitely need the protection for our children and the children of the state that fluoridation can bring. We are 48th out of the 50 states in Oregon to in fluoridation. This is a bill that will help to stop dental decay or dental caries in its tracks, and I urge you to consider it and pass it to the floor. I'd like to just tell one little story, that personal story that I had, that you'll probably be hearing a number of some testimony that it is a danger to us. But I think one of the most telling stories that I had, when I was a junior in dental school, we had my professor of biochemistry, Leonard Fosdick, was the head of the committee that was to fluoridate the city of Chicago back in the late 50s. Dr. Fosdick told us a funny story that when they went to fluoridate, they felt that they owed it to the citizens of Chicago to warn them ahead of time that this was coming. So they placed ads in all the major newspapers, the Daily News, the Trib, the Sun-Times, and told people that on a certain date, the water of Chicago would be fluoridated, and listed all of the benefits. Well, the day came and passed, and the next morning, the lines lit up, the papers were flooded, all of the folks that opposed it called in to say, I've got all these terrible maladies that are happening to me. That evening in the paper, they had to place a retraction that, in fact, something had gone wrong. They hadn't been able to fluoridate the water. They did 2 weeks later, and nobody ever heard anything afterwards. So believe me, there's good reason to believe that we're not going to suffer in any way, but in fact we're going to prosper greatly from having fluoride in our water.
Thank you. Representative Greenland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here to balance the country boy from Eastern Oregon as a city kid from Western Oregon. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, Northwest Portland, on out to North Plains, half of your district, Mr. Chair. I'm here on two accounts. I'm here first as a representative, as one of the legislative members of the Oregon Health Policy Commission, a group we established in the 72nd Legislative Assembly to look at health policy issues. You all have, I believe, a letter from the commission. This bill came to legislature courtesy of the commission, and the commission really believes this may be the most important thing we could do for the public health in the state of Oregon in this legislative session, and urges again that you pass this out of committee with a due pass recommendation to the floor. I'm also here as a public health scientist. I've been a member of the National Academy of Sciences since 1971 in the Institute of Medicine. I've studied this issue. I remember doing my first study on it as a first-year doctoral student in 1961, nearly 45 years ago. I am also convinced that this activity, fluoridating the water, is a perfectly 100% safe process, and that we could save thousands of people having very difficult dental problems by fluoridating the water system. I expect you'll hear from some other dentists, pediatric dentists, who can tell you they can look at the mouth of a child and tell just by looking at the mouth whether they've been in an area that's had fluoridated water or not. This is a absolutely critical issue. It is an issue of money, but more importantly, it's an issue of health. Good oral health is so very important to the lives of people, and this very simple and very safe technique can really save just untold years of misery for people who will end up with serious dental health problems if we don't have fluoridation in the water. So I, again, just on both counts, urge you to pass this bill, and hope you'll do so. And I really do thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk outside of the constraints you put on the debate.
Senator Atkinson, you have something to share with the committee room?
I bet your wife calling to tell you you need to be in favor of this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
I don't think there's a problem.
I knew.
I couldn't help myself.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Atkinson.
My wife's a dental hygienist. I'm telling you, either system, I'm a no win on this whole.
Easy win.
Easy win.
Thanks for your testimony. I've never studied this issue until about 2 or 3 months ago. I was completely ignorant of both sides. To me, it's not as clear-cut as you lay out. I have an email from some dentist in Lake Oswego who says He's been a general and public health dentist for 25 years, who's always promoted water fluoridation. More recent research has convinced me water fluoridation, and then et cetera, et cetera. So he's on the other side of this. And these kinds of emails and other communications I receive convince me that it's not quite so simple. But I do appreciate your testimony. Senator Shields, do you have any questions?
No, I'm in the same position. I keep getting emails, and I try to look for those that are professionals as opposed to those that aren't. And I'm getting really frustrated by the competing sciences that I see, because I do listen, and I do notice when it's a dentist or somebody like that. I'm also concerned about the FDA and their non-role in this over the last 50 years.
Well, fluoride isn't a medication in the same sense any more than chlorine is a medication in the water. I mean, it might be a DEQ issue, but it's really, FDA has never considered fluoride in the water system as a medication. And in a sense, it's not. It's a mineral supplement. Even sold over the counter, it's not in that sense. So, I think the issue that FDA has not been in it is because it's not really in FDA's purview to be in it. I do ask you to look very carefully at the science, as I've done over the years. I don't think there's a public health... Let me say, public health scientists are very concerned about the precautionary rule. Public health scientists say very clearly, don't do anything unless you're really convinced that it's not harmful. They're not... They will almost never take the position, it's okay to do it unless we can prove it's a problem. So we're very much concerned with the precautionary rule, and we urge it on drug companies, we urge it in a lot of different things. Frankly, the evidence that I've seen, and the evidence that I think will come out of any school of public health in the country, and you may have some studies in there from schools of public health that are contrary to that, but I followed the literature very carefully until maybe I got embroiled in other things 2 or 3 years ago here. I mean, I don't know a legitimate public health toxicologist or environmental health scientist that has done a study that's indicated there's any harm for the implementation of fluorine in the water system.
I rather than have this exchange continue, I would rather hear from the people who I think have the lots of degrees behind their name that we can hear the science from. But I really do. Any further questions, though, from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that. Representative Dalto, do you want to add to the... Okay. Dr. Myers, then, why don't you... Jane Myers. I try to promote people. I'd like you to arrange for the proponents as you want to. On this bill.
Well, I'm going to be very brief. Jane Myers for the Oregon Dental Association and for as coordinator of the Healthy Smiles Coalition in support of House Bill 2025. We have a notebook for you, and the witnesses you're going to hear from today in this order we think would be most helpful. Dr. Kurt Frey will speak to you. He's a dentist, works at the Kaiser Permanente Clinic in Portland, and he's going to speak about the burden of the disease, which takes in cost and all. And then we have two people from the Centers for Disease Control on the telephone, Dr. William Moss and Kip Duchant, who's a fluoridation engineer. And they're mostly available for questions, but they are going to address the issues of purity, which I think is in the minds of a lot of people on the committee, and a few other questions. And they're going to try to be real brief. There's some printed testimony from them in the notebook. If you want to read it at greater length, please do so. It's very informative. Dr. Mike Meredith from OHSU is here to speak to some issues that have been raised about lead and arsenic in the water additives. Dr. Mel Cohn from the Department of Human Services, he's a state epidemiologist.
I just want to tell you, I think we better get these people going, because in 20 minutes we're shifting to the other side, even if we don't have them done.
And I'd like to invite Dr. Frey and Dr. Meredith up to the podium. And if you
CDC.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and put them on now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
Would you like me to begin?
Well, we'll try to do one thing at a time here.
Okay. No problem.
Even that gets challenged.
These two should be together. They should both be there for the answer.
Hello, this is Kimsey Shawn, Bill Moss, and Bill Bailey with the CDC.
Hi, that's not a recording. That's live, what you're saying, right?
I hope so.
Okay, thank you. This is Senator Charlie Ringo, and you're on a speakerphone that's in the Oregon Senate Committee on Land Use and the Environment. So welcome very much. We also have the table Dr. Ferrer, and Malcone.
No, the empty chair is Malcolm.
No. And you, I'm sorry, you are?
Mike Meredith,
I'm sorry about that. And so just to let you know, that's the setup, and we've got a committee room full of people listening to you, so let's go ahead. And Dr. Ferre, would you like to begin?
Thank you. Senator Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Kurt Ferre, and I'm a general dentist in Portland, and I'm representing the Oregon Dental Association. I am here this afternoon to enlist your support in the fight to prevent dental cavities. As a dentist, I am well aware of the burden of this disease. None of you, fortunately, will ever have to face a young child and listen to him or her scream while tears flow down mom's face. It's an experience that one never gets used to and motivates me to come here and ask for your support. Dental cavities are a preventable disease, and fluoridation is the cornerstone of a comprehensive oral health policy for any state. When a community water system is not fluoridated, the burden of disease falls disproportionately on the poor, especially children. There's also a big cost to the state for dental care and Medicaid. Lost days from school and work are another part of this burden, and we know that children in pain do not learn well. In the Oregon Department of Human Services SMILE survey of 2002, children who qualify for free and reduced meals at school were nearly three times more likely to have untreated cavities. Children of color in non-English speaking households are nearly twice as likely as white children to have dental cavities. Let me share with you some statistics provided to me by Dr. Kyle House, a pediatric dentist who treats many children from Hood River, which is not fluoridated, and the Dalles, which is 20 miles east, a town that has been fluoridated since 1955. In the Dalles Head Start screening, 21% of the children ages 3 to 5 were diagnosed with cavities, and zero were found to have serious cavities. In contrast, in the Hood River Head Start screening, 46% of the children ages 3 to 5 were diagnosed with cavities, but 9 were found to have serious cavities requiring general anesthesia. Hospitalization is costly, but necessary to treat many of these young patients with serious dental disease due to their inability to tolerate dental procedures on an outpatient basis. Here's what it costs at Providence Hospital in Hood River for a typical dental case. $5,200 is the flat fee for a 60 to 90 minute case in the operating room. An additional $500 for each 15 minute block of time. And this doesn't include Dr. House's fees. In 2004, for Dr. House's hospital cases involving only children from the Hood River city limits versus the Dalles, the bill for the net hospital billings were $159,613 in Hood River. In contrast, the Dalles was $87,298. Dividing by the population of each town, the cost per person in Hood River was $27. In the Dalles, it was 26% of that, only $7. Again, this does not include Dr. House's fees. We cannot afford to be indifferent to the burden carried by our patients, their families, and society for a disease that is totally preventable. Former Surgeon General Dr. David Satcher, in his address to the Oregon Legislative Breakfast in January, said, "Government has a responsibility to be representative to all people. This bill is about social equity and deserves your support. We ask that you move it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation." Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you, Dr. Frey. I just have a couple questions. I read a report that said that the American Dental Association Journal published an article in the year 2000 essentially stating that the benefits of fluoride are not systemic, that they're topical.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a new finding in the year 2000, a new conclusion.
Actually, I know that study quite well, and it's authored by Dr. John Featherstone from the University of California, San Francisco. He's actually a researcher and not a dentist, and all his studies were done topically. I've had the opportunity to meet him in person last year at the National Oral Health Conference, and I'll probably see him next week when I go to Pittsburgh. That study conveniently leaves out very important facts, and that is that the most effective way to deliver multiple low doses of fluoride is via water fluoridation. Dr. Featherstone, in his article, is a strong supporter of water fluoridation.
I guess the question it raised in my mind was it indicates that very recently, just in the last 5 years, we've received substantial new information as to how the benefits of fluoride accrue to people.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me increases the level of uncertainty when some people say, well, is fluoride good or how good? I believe me, I accept that there are a lot of benefits to fluoride. I mean, I've heard enough people say that I
right.
believe it. But it seems there's a lot of uncertainty, though, about the mechanism of that. And 5 years to make that dramatic shift in analysis.
You know, actually, this is not a dramatic shift. I mean, this has been researched and argued amongst the dental professional for years. Actually, Dr. Featherstone's predecessor is Dr. Ernest Newbrum. He's a professor emeritus at University of California, San Francisco. Also the head of the California Fluoridation Task Force. And he strongly believes that there's a pre-eruptive benefit of water fluoridation. I have two references that I could get to you that clearly describe that there is a benefit. And so for you and me, the benefit is topical. But again, Dr. Featherstone, even though that is his personal belief, he is a strong supporter of fluoridation because, again, he says the most effective way to deliver multiple low doses of fluoridation or fluoride is via fluoridation.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Beyer, Atkinson, you have any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Meredith?
Yes. For the record, I'm Michael Meredith, professor of biochemistry in the Department of Integrative Biosciences at the Oregon Health Sciences University. I'm here today to speak primarily to the questions of contaminations of fluoridating stock materials, lead and arsenic to be specific. But there's no reason to go through the arguments for fluoridation. They're, as the committee knows, about the mechanisms of pre- and post-eruptive maturation of teeth, how fluoride gets in there both as the tooth develops and later after the tooth emerges from the gingiva and is remineralized. Senator Atkinson is looking knowledgeably. He's heard this from his wife before. My wife is a hygienist also, so I do understand your position.
Do you have to go to dental school with her?
No. I got the benefits afterwards. There's no disagreement about the benefits of fluoridation. We're in the 60th year of fluoridation in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That community has had the most intensive prospective epidemiology of any municipality in the country looking for differences induced by fluoridation. They were the first. There are none, except that they have a lot better teeth than their control populations. There's no argument about the cost. For every dollar we put into fluoridation, we get back $38 in saved dental expenses, and that's community health dollars for the most part. Things coming out of taxpayer coffers. So given that fluoridation is, I think, without question, a beneficial thing, and actually the The topical effect of fluoride goes back to the late 40s. So this is not big news, Senator Ringo. We've known about that for a very long time.
Well, the reason I raise that, it appeared to be big news, that it was a new analysis regarding how fluoride benefits people. That's my understanding.
If you read it very carefully, what they actually have said is that the period from which you can benefit by post-eruptive maturation, that is, fluoride's effect topically, is much longer in the lifespan than is the pre-eruptive, the tooth development period. I want to focus on fluorosilicic acid, which is the most common of the fluoridating agents. Sodium fluoride is the other one. Fluorosilicic acid seems to come in for the most examination because it's the least pure of the two. Sodium fluoride is prepared specifically and is of reagent grade quality. That is, its impurities are well below detectable limits. Fluorosilicic acid, contrary to what some people would tell you, is not an industrial waste product. It, in fact, is a co-product of phosphate isolation, and on a value basis is more expensive than the phosphate that is purified from. Fluorosilicic acid is essential for the manufacturing of glass, mineral refinement, a number of industrial processes, and the demands of the users of fluorosilicic acid as far as purity are very high. Water fluoridation is actually one of the smallest applications of fluorosilicic acid. In that list of contaminants that are present in fluorosilicic acid, lead and arsenic attract the most attention. Now, lead is a health risk. We have known this since the Romans introduced lead plumbing. Plumbium is the Latin for lead, which is where the word plumbing comes from. The concentration of lead to which we're exposed, the intake of lead in the 1940s was somewhere around 500 micrograms a day. This was mostly in the form of lead paint and aerosol lead. In 1995, that had been reduced by conscious effort to about 100 micrograms of lead per day. We can probably still go down further than that. The question that's germane to this discussion is how much of that can be attributed to impurities in water fluoridating materials. And in the materials that you'll get, we've gone through a calculation showing that it is a truly insignificant amount, but I want to give you a presay of the highlights of that. In studies of one study that looked at 18,000 water districts and another one that looked at 1,800 water districts, specifically to compare fluoridated and non-fluoridated levels, non-fluoridated and non-fluoridated water supplies, we found that the average exposure to lead in water is about 10 micrograms per day. Of that 10 micrograms, how much is due to fluoridation? If you look at the literature on the effects of lead, we know that lead has developmental and neurological complications. And a paper that's generally cited, and I'm sure you have a copy of it, is by Canfield et al., that appeared in the New England Journal of Medicine, showing that bloodborne lead of 10 micrograms has a deleterious effect as measured in IQ scores. Now, let me reinforce what I just said. Bloodborne lead. That's lead in the blood. That's lead that's come into the body, made its way into the circulation system. And I'm sure you've seen the most disingenuous sorts of calculations saying that if Oregon fluoridates its water, its children will undergo a 2.6 IQ point decline. That sort of linear analysis is just not correct, and in fact muddies the water with hyperbole. If you look at the 10 most common sources of fluorosilicic acid, the average maximum amount of lead found in these is 11.4 parts per billion. That's micrograms of lead per liter of water. If we take the dirtiest of those, which was 20 parts per million lead, 20 milligrams per liter, which had a fluoride content of 18% fluoride. Now let's fluoridate some water with that. How much do you need? Well, you need 0.0083 mils of that fluorosilicic acid, because it is a liquid at room temperature, to fluoridate a liter of water. How much lead is that? Very, very little. 0.0005 nanograms of lead. It's vanishingly small. Okay, so the lead produced by that fluoridation, which would, given average water consumption, is about 0.8 micrograms per day, that constitutes 0.008% of our 100 microgram daily exposure. This is not an important source of lead. So the production of, or the introduction of lead through fluorosilicic acid is just not very important. I need to talk on about arsenic too for a minute. In the same studies that found the very low levels of lead as the 18,000 water test samples, we found that water testing, that water supplies provide about 0.1 parts per billion. That's billion with a B. That's nanograms per liter of arsenic, mostly as arsenate, ASO4. Given the same sort of water intake, that is an amount of arsenic in a day that's about 1/200th of what you got in your salmon steak last night. And so a naive assumption is we want to get arsenic out of the river, let's keep those pesky salmon out of the Columbia, because they're bringing it back from the ocean where it's a naturally occurring material. So arsenic is also is found in such small levels that it's really not worth mentioning. Okay, you're right, Senator Ringo, it's never this simple. We can add up all the numbers, we can do all of this, but unless you understand what happens to something in water after you drink the water, you're not getting the full picture. This group here, we're going to absorb about 5 to 10% of the lead we take in a day. Now, that's lead that's either as elemental lead or ionic lead, charged lead ion. Your kids, if they're under 10, are going to take in about 30% of the lead. Right? So children will absorb more lead from the diet, or more lead to be taken in. What form is the lead in? Unless lead can be absorbed, it's passed through in the feces. There's a listing in the material you'll get that shows that most of the lead that is going to appear in fluorosilicic acid is non-absorbable, insoluble lead. It's just not taken up. So in conclusion, let me assure you that within the best analysis I can make, lead and arsenic are straw men, thrown up because they're words that people know. Lead is a risk in the environment. We need to reduce lead, but lead in as a consequence of fluoridation is not very important.
Thank you. I have a few questions. I received a note from Dr. April Love, mm-hmm. who said, well, you know, there is somewhat of a compromise, and that is to allow fluoride, but as the sodium fluoride.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a step?
Sodium fluoride, if you look at New Hampshire is a state that gets looked at first because it's small, and it's been fluoridating for a number of years. About half of the water districts use sodium fluoride, about half use fluorosilicic acid. Sodium fluoride is more expensive, but it's easier to handle for small water treatment plants than is fluorosilicic acid. The water quality as measured from either of these sources is not distinguishable. There's no measurable difference between them. However, at the stock material level, sodium fluoride is a cleaner material because it's sold as an ACS reagent grade material, whereas fluorosilicic acid does have some stated impurities.
So you would say that it would increase the costs somewhat, but the benefits would be negligible.
Right. And actually the cost is going to depend upon the water district itself. As I said, a small water district, depending on, and if Kip is still on the phone, he can speak to the mechanisms of fluoridation.
Okay. Just another question, maybe for Dr. Ferre. I've received emails from people who've expressed they've said they have special health difficulties, such as people with thyroid problems or liver problems.
Mm-hmm.
Either one of you, I don't care who answers it, but does fluoride have some ill effects for people that do have special health problems?
You mentioned thyroid.
Yes,
yeah.
I believe so.
Yeah, I don't have it with me, but there's a professor emeritus, an endocrinologist, last name Volpe from Toronto, and he actually addressed this specific issue. And he said that fluoride is temporarily picked up by the thyroid, but is not kept. It doesn't become part of thyroid hormone or thyroxine. So his conclusion was that fluoridation has no effect on someone that would be, say, hypothyroid.
Do we know of other people that, because of just special health
issues or sensitivities are subject to
health problems. Well, I mean, I could go to organization after organization, like the American Academy of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology. You know, some people will say they're allergic to fluoride. Fluoride is the 13th most common element in the Earth's crust. It's very hard to avoid. You know, I mean, virtually
it's life. Then,
yeah, it's life. I mean, basically, if you're allergic to fluoride, you could say, "Well, I'm allergic to oxygen."
Yeah, but you understand what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's one thing to say it benefits 99% of the people in mm-hmm. society, but I am interested if there are 1% out there that have a special sensitivity to fluoride that are going to have ill effects.
Well,
and if the answer is no, just tell me no. I don't know.
No. Well, I know.
Okay, he said no. Thank you.
Okay.
On the question of allergies, people become allergic to small molecules when small molecules attach to things like serum albumin.
Well, I don't know how to respond when I get an email from somebody who says they have a liver problem, and fluoride presents a special difficulty.
Not
to
metabolically.
Them. Okay.
All right. Fluoride is cleared as a small molecule in the kidneys at the levels you see even in very heavily fluoridated areas. And natural fluoridation does occur naturally. Even in those very heavily fluoridated areas, hepatotoxicity is not one of the concerns of fluoridation.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Questions from the committee? All right. Let's go to the folks on the phone.
Senator Ringo, if we haven't used our time, could we ask the CDC to say a word about purity? Because I think that is one of the confused parts of the issue that
I think you have used your time, but I want to get to the bottom of this, so I want to keep talking about this. So
thank you.
Are there folks on the CDC who can respond to this the topic we were just discussing?
Yes, my name is William Moss. I'm the director of the Division of Oral Health at CDC, and with me is Kip Dushana, environmental engineer with the division.
Are you guys down in Atlanta?
Yes, we're in Atlanta, and we came out some time ago and visited with the House of Representatives Water Committee and left written testimony. Both of us left written testimony, and I hope had the opportunity to review that.
Yes, actually, I've got it here, so I'll take a look at it.
And basically, to summarize that testimony, we said fluoridation is safe, effective, and cost-effective, and it's the single most important public health measure that a policymaker can do to assure good oral health. Now, we speaking to the issue that was just raised about whether there are some people that are sensitive to fluoride, realize that the National Academy of Sciences National Research Council, at the request of the EPA, in 1993 issued a comprehensive report. And it's reports like this that are the basis for CDC's assurance of the safety of water fluoridation. Those scientists, an independent panel, reviewed all of the evidence of all of the possible health concerns. And they were looking at fluoride levels as it occurs naturally in the water at times, many times higher than the levels that are advocated for good dental health. So if people were sensitive to high levels of fluoride, we would be able to detect that in communities where, because of the natural high levels, people are receiving high levels of fluoride. And that is not just the case in the United States, but all over the world there are people drinking fluoride at high levels. And so there's plenty of opportunity to study. These scientists reviewed publications from scientists all over the world, and their assessment was, at that time, that there was no reason for the EPA to change its maximum contaminant level of 4 parts per million for fluoride. And obviously we're advocating a level for optimum fluoride much below that. So I think that issue about health effects of sensitive people is already addressed by the EPA standards. The other thing I wanted to comment on was the question you asked about Featherstone's 2000 article about the topical effects of fluoride. And I think Dr. Meredith answered that well. The significance of that article was not that it was new. That information was 10 or 15 years old. But in bringing it to the attention of the dentist, it was to remind people that we do not need to fixate on the health benefits of fluoridation, of fluoridated water, just for children who are in the tooth-forming years. But fluoridation benefits people of all ages, and it's the topical effect which predominates over a lifetime. In CDC's own report, we talked about the topical effects predominating. Not to say that there aren't systemic effects, but that the topical effects are what makes it work for a whole lifetime. In fact, after Featherstone's 2000 article and after our recommendations on the use of fluoride, a researcher named Singh in Australia did a very careful study of children looking children who had opportunity to have systemic fluoride at different ages, and they found that the maximum caries protection was children that had both the systemic and the topical benefits. So we know that there's evidence of systemic benefits, but again, the point is we advocate it for its topical benefits. Water fluoridation improves the oral health of all ages in your community.
Okay, thank
now,
you.
On the
just a couple more minutes, please.
Okay. Now I understand that that some people are advocating that we should use only water that meets the standards of fluoride additives that are that should be approved by the Food and Drug Administration. That somehow that would be a pure additive. And that's really incorrect, and I want to explain that the Safe Drinking Water Act of 1974, which provides for the enhancement of the safety of the public drinking water, through establishing national regulations, gave the EPA the primary responsibility for establishing those regulations. And in 1984, EPA had a Federal Register announcement of two important decisions. One, it referenced the 1979 agreement between the Food and Drug Administration and the EPA that established the EPA's authority over drinking water. It retained for the FDA the authority over bottled water and water used for food processing. The other important decision in that 1984 Federal Register notice was that it established a testing program for water additives, a private sector program with EPA oversight to assure the purity of drinking water additives. And since then, the American Water Works Association and NSF International have taken responsibility to assure the purity of drinking water additives, including fluoride. And the experiences of the NSF International is that in over 500 samples analyzed, arsenic was only detected in one of five samples. And where it was detected, it was at low levels, and the significance of those low levels was described by Dr. Meredith. I think it's necessary to realize that detecting it is not necessarily bad. That's an indication that our monitoring program to assure the safety of drinking water additives is functioning. The low level detected assures that when it's diluted at the levels where it's applied into drinking water, that the resulting level of arsenic will be undetectable. Undetectable whether you're using FSA, the acid, or the sodium fluoride. As it was reported in New Hampshire, the quality for the water is indistinguishable.
Just another minute, please. We need to wrap this up pretty quickly.
So the other thing that I wanted to mention is that I'm aware that there's some concern about whether the decision should be made at the state level or should be left to local decision making. And I hope you can appreciate that this is a very complicated issue and recognize that you've had the opportunity to review evidence and seek the opinions of experts such as those that are convened today. Your constituents don't have that opportunity. Any decision made at a level which, at that level, does not have the benefit of the information that you have today. Public health decisions should be made on the basis of the best available understanding of the issue. You have the opportunity to do that. Leaving the decision for others to make at some future unspecified time with less information and decreased ability to make the decision hardly seems prudent. You make difficult decisions on behalf of the public all the time, and you have the information you need to make.
All right. We don't need a lecture there. But I've got a question for you. Is the question of whether adding fluoride to the water is for medicinal purposes? It seems to me that it is. I mean, you're adding it to the water to provide a health benefit. Isn't that medicinal?
Well, that's not the view we take. The fluoride occurs naturally in water, and we are recommending that that level be adjusted to a level that provides optimal health. Fluoride, a nutrient, more than it is a medicine.
Okay. I'm just... All right.
Use that term, but that's not a... That's a, you know, you can make up anything. It doesn't really represent what we're trying to adjust.
That's okay. That's okay. What? Who else there wants to testify? Is there somebody else from CDC that wants to testify?
Mr. Kip Deshaun, the fluoridation engineer, is available. We reviewed our testimony together. He's available to answer questions you would have about engineering or technical aspects.
Well, I don't think the committee has any more questions. You know, I really appreciate your testimony. I'm going to read all the material that I have. I'm sure the other committee members will, and we'll continue to chew away on this issue. So thank you very much. I appreciate that. And let's go ahead and hang up. And I want to recess this committee for about 5 minutes, and then we'll start with the opponents to the bill. So the Committee on Land Use Environment is recessed for about 5 minutes. Can you get Environment and Land Use. Just to the audience, we are going to have three quick hearings on three quick bills, and then we'll get back to the fluoride wars. So I appreciate those for you here on the fluoride issue. I appreciate your indulgence. I'd like to open a work session on Senate Bill 740 to the committee administrator. The dash two amendments are the operative amendments. And we adopt these amendments, and then it's on its way to Ways and Means. All right. Chair moves the adoption of the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 740. First of all, we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 740. Chair moves the adoption of the dash two amendments. Is there any discussion?
I won't object to amendment.
Any objection? So ordered. Chair moves Senate Bill 740 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yeah, I'm a no.
Okay.
McPeter's here.
You want to go ahead and call the roll, please?
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Senator
Thank you.
No.
Senator Courtney?
Yes.
Senator Reagan?
Aye.
You won't do it for me?
Did you ask me to?
Vote carries, I will go ahead and carry that bill.
That's
the Ways and Means. I guess we don't need to carry bills. So let's go ahead and close that public work session. Let's open a work session on
Mr. Chair.
Senate Bill 542. Senator Atkinson?
Who is our special guest, the phantom voter down there on the far right?
You'll have to meet him someday. Does he let you in his office?
Oh.
Sorry.
No, he doesn't care. He doesn't
Does he
care.
Have an office?
He doesn't care about me.
He doesn't care about anybody.
He doesn't care about any of us.
If he cared, he'd sit over here on the far left.
Yeah. He's on the far right, the extreme far right.
There's no amendments to 542, right?
Yes.
Can we ask some questions on these work sessions? We're game. That's why I had the administrator lead off early on.
No, I mean him.
We'll ask him. Yeah, you better not. That might cause some problems. We are in public work session on Senate Bill 542. Chair moves the dash one amendments. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair moves that on Senate Bill 542 we rescind the Ways and Means referral and move it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
No.
Any objection? Yes. Please call the roll.
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Burdick?
Senator
Shields?
Aye.
Mr. Atkinson?
Aye.
Yes.
Chair Ringo?
Aye.
I didn't call you.
And Senate Bill 542 passes, and again, I will carry that bill.
Avell
asked that I carry it.
Oh, okay.
Oh, well, then I'm a no.
Yeah, he's the only one that's allowed to carry bills in this.
And let's open a work session on Senate Bill 659. Could you just briefly describe the dash one amendments?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. President, members of the committee, the dash one amendments to 659 are a gut and stuff. They replace the original bill. What we are replacing it with is an expenditure limitation for the Oregon Forest Resources Institute. The amendments contain a blank, which would be filled by the Ways and Means Committee with the level of the limitation.
Thank you. Chair moves the dash one amendments. Is there any discussion?
No on this amendment.
No on the amendment.
Senator Courtney's enjoying this too much. Katie, could you call the roll, please?
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Gray? Senator
Shields? Aye.
Mr. Atkinson?
No.
President Courtney?
Yes.
Chair Bingo?
Yes.
getting a workout day down there, yeah?
Dash one amendments pass. Chair moves Senate Bill 659 as amended to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion?
Just no again.
Katie, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Byers?
No.
Senator Gruding? Senator Shields?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
No.
President Courtney?
Yes.
Chair Ringo?
Yes. And Senate Bill 659 passes and is referred to Ways and Means. Thank you very much, Mr. President. We appreciate that.
Mr. President, you need to stay for the rest of the floor, I think.
Yeah, you don't want to miss that. It's stimulating.
Thank you.
It's like pulling teeth to get him to stay.
Yeah. Senator Shields, thank you. Let's return to our public hearing on Senate Bill 2025. And if Brent, you could come up, that'd be great. Thank you, Senator Shields.
I'll be here till 4:30.
All right. Stop it, baby. You know, just excuse me, Representative Barnhart, I might have brought you up, but is what we were hoping to do is give the anti-fluoride folks about 20 minutes, and then we'll go immediately to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is that okay?
We'll be back in 20.
That would be great.
Thank you
very much. Is there someplace we can call you?
Yes, my office.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll call you in 20 minutes. Go ahead.
Chair Ringo, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Campbell. I'm with Oregon Citizens for Safe Drinking Water. Wow, we've heard a lot of stuff today that I would very much like to respond to, and I was going to take about 7 minutes and had prepared remarks. So I hope that you'll entertain some responses in writing after today.
The short answer is yes, and I say that to both sides of this debate. If you feel like you want to respond to horrible falsehoods that the other side has set forth, get us them in writing.
And I guess the one thing that I will respond to up front is that I'm hoping that you've all had a chance to look at the FDA document we provided to you that was provided to a U.S. U.S. House Committee on Science, indicating very clearly in FDA's own words that fluoride, when ingested for the purpose of reducing tooth decay, is a drug under FDA regulation. So I'm really confused about why you have to have a prescription to go and buy it, but everybody wants to pretend that for some reason, once it goes in the water, it's not a drug. Okay, if public health policy should reflect current valid science and help rather than hurt people, especially children, we urge you on the committee to vote no on this bill. In fact, today's science is so damaging to fluoridation's credibility, it has spawned a growing movement of scrutiny and concern. For example, UNICEF, a respected advocate for children, in its report on fluoride says, "We've always known that too much causes harm, but now, quote, scientists are now debating whether fluoride in water confers any benefit at all, and that truly is a question of scientific debate." For years, the Union of Scientists at EPA headquarters has been calling for a moratorium on fluoridation. They've studied the science and have said, quote, "As professionals charged with assessing the safety of drinking water, we conclude that the health and welfare of the public is not served by the addition of this substance to the water supply." World Health Organization data on the screen shows that tooth decay has dropped in comparable levels in both fluoridated and non-fluoridated industrialized countries. In the U.S., it is now concentrated, according to the CDC, in low-income families without access to care. And I cannot emphasize enough, this is the real problem that we should be dealing with today. Access to care, not access to fluoridation. Fluoridation is not going to solve that problem. Only 25% of kids today account for 80% of the decay in children's permanent teeth. That's different than when I was a kid, and maybe when you were kids. I may be older, not sure. I want to focus on three science-related points. While emotional arguments are sexy and it's verifiable science, that should inform your decision. These are some of the scientific bombshells we believe are leading to fluoridation's demise. And I have to take exception with what's been said today about the fact that the science now shows this is... Fluoridation was based on this assumption. It was a theory that children had to swallow and incorporate fluoride into developing teeth to get a protective benefit. That theory has been disproved. The new research that's supported by the CDC and explained in their big report on fluoride of 2001 shows that fluoride's mechanism is topical, not systemic, and it works by direct contact with teeth after they've developed, not before, after they've developed and erupted into the mouth. The idea that systemic exposure from tap water could provide a topical effect by increasing levels in the ductal saliva sounds really good, but the CDC responded to that too and said, no, the concentration is too low at only 16 parts per billion to have an anti-caries effect. We finally have proof of fluoride's topical effect, but I will take exception with what's been said. According to Hardy Lineback, head of preventive dentistry at the University of Toronto, and I've looked for them myself, we don't have any solid, well-controlled studies showing that there's any systemic benefit. They haven't removed the topical effect, and so the two are mixed up together, and we haven't been able to pull them out. Second, fluoridation... if fluoridation is primarily a systemic modality, the question is it today, is it really working? If so, we should be seeing significant reductions in tooth decay and very little dental fluorosis. But in fact, our best evidence, and this, both sides agree, this is the largest, most detailed survey ever conducted in the U.S., and it found just the opposite. In 86-87, the National Institutes of Dental Research looked at 39,000 school kids in 84 different areas. The results were written up, one study on decay, and the other on fluorosis. The difference in decay between the always fluoridated and the never fluoridated groups of children was tiny. It was consistent with findings. Yeah.
Can you think about that? I assume that these dentists and dental experts that have testified are pretty smart people that have read this. So why does this not change their mind?
I'm wondering why such smart people report an 18% difference when there is a 0.6 out of 128 tooth surface difference. I mean, we've got the numbers right there. Kids have 128 tooth surfaces in their mouth, and there are the numbers, 2.79 compared to 3.39.
Well, I guess is what I'm wondering is why aren't they persuaded by this paper, by these arguments?
You tell me.
Well, okay.
0.6 of 128 tooth surfaces is less than one half of 1% difference. It was properly reported by the Chemical and Engineering News that the tooth decay in this largest survey ever done was nearly identical, and you can see it for yourself. We think it is inappropriate that the authors, instead of dividing the 0.6 into 128, divided it into the 3.3 and came up with an 18% reduction. You can look at the numbers and you can see that that doesn't make any sense. This is not a significant reduction. And I didn't mean to be disrespectful, Chair Ringo, for the question. Thank
We're
you.
We're less disrespectful than Senator Atkinson. So that's fine.
Even the 0.6 is suspect, according to Dr. Lineback, who indicates that it's well known that fluoridation delays the eruption of permanent teeth by about a year. So decay in non-fluoridated children shows up faster. They're exposed to sugar longer, making decay rates seem slightly higher. And this delay is never controlled for in the studies. So what about, in the same big study, what about the rates of dental fluorosis? Were they comparable? No. Compare the 13.5% of children in non-fluoridated areas affected compared to the 29.9% in the optimally fluoridated group. That's more than double the rate of dental fluorosis. And that's just on two or more teeth. If you add in the damage, which is in the middle column, the 0.5 column, to just one tooth, the totals jump to 40% in the non-fluoridated and 66% in the optimally fluoridated group. Frankly, this is pretty unbelievable. Fluorosis is permanent damage to teeth, defined in Tabor's Medical Encyclopedia as chronic fluorine poisoning. The goal of fluoridation is to reduce decay without causing dental fluorosis, yet two-thirds of these kids were affected in some way, a clear and visible warning that fluoride exposure is excessive and out of control. Which brings me to my final point. Increases in dental fluorosis have been so dramatic in the U.S. that prescription doses for kids in non-fluoridated areas were reduced in 1994. Amazingly, no similar precautions were taken for fluoridated children who are still getting one part per million, the original dose established back in, the original concentration established back in 1945 in the drinking water. This is not rocket science. Anybody can figure out that at one part per million, every cup of water delivers a quarter milligram. And if you look at the dosage schedule, you see that a quarter milligram is the full daily prescription dose for a six-month to a three-year-old. Newborns aren't supposed to have any, and the 3 to 6-year-olds only a half milligram a day. So what does this mean? It means that fluoridated children under six are being significantly and chronically over-medicated on a daily basis. The water is used to make soup, jello juice, rice, oatmeal, etc., plus what's used for drinking. A two-year-old ingesting 2 to 4 cups of water a day is getting 200 to 400% of the recommended dose. No doctor could ethically prescribe this much fluoride, and we've got proof in the NIDR study that 66% of kids are paying the price of excessive exposure in permanent damage to teeth. Is this responsible public health policy? I would say no. Why anyone would continue to support this systemic intervention using a contaminated, unapproved drug that's questionably beneficial in water while clearly over-medicating young children and causing massive levels of permanent visible damage is frankly mystifying. Endorsements unfortunately sway people, but they do not substitute for science, and when the science is scrutinized without bias, fluoridation falls apart. Please, water fluoridation would cost tens of millions of dollars. Know that we have safer, healthier, more effective ways to help the targeted group, the low-income kids. Please protect Oregon's kids and vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Ms. Campbell, we have a lot of written material. Is what you just said, has that been provided to us?
This?
Your written testimony?
Yes, I will.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I have copies.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. Foster, why don't you go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Ringo and our committee members. I appreciate your opportunity to give testimony here today. My name is Brent Foster. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club and Columbia Riverkeeper. I want to touch on two issues, some of which we talked about before. The first is the issue of contaminants in the drinking water as a result of fluoride addition, and the second is the fluoride itself. I'm not going to try to convince you that fluoride has adverse health effects and what have you in the course of 5 minutes, but I do want to point out a couple things that I think should have at least raise some questions in your mind about what was presented as the diehard facts, that there's no potential for human health effects from fluoride addition. First off, let's be clear. This is from the Center for Disease Control top fluoride engineer. All of fluoride chemicals used in the U.S. for water fluoridation are byproducts of the phosphate fertilizer industry. Okay, co-products, byproducts, whatever you want to call them, they're coming from the waste stream, what would otherwise have to be handled as hazardous waste. And this is put out by Thomas Reeves, who is the National Fluoridation Engineer for CDC. That inherently raises some questions about what else is in the water, and this is a document that you have provided. This is from a letter written from NSF International, which is essentially the water of the consortium of water providers. This is the entity that regulates and at least oversees and does some monitoring of what contains water additives. Specifically, in response to congressional requests, they came up with this chart. They showed this is compounds that are found in fluoridated water that comes out of the tap directly as a result of fluoridation. Dr. Meredith from OHSU presented some other data on lead and arsenic, I went up to him. I said, "Well, where was that data?" And he referred me. He said, "Well, it's referenced in a medical study." And I asked him if he'd even read the study. And in fact, he hadn't even read the study, which he cites. These are the most current information that we have. It's before you. It's to Congress, and it's certainly credible to rely on. Arsenic and lead, the two numbers that he relied on, 1.66 parts per billion of arsenic. Certainly, it's not a lot of arsenic, at least on the surface.
Can I ask you a question? This list of materials here, are we confident? Okay, there's mercury. What other might have health impacts? Arsenic, lead, mercury?
Certainly cadmium. It can have real problems depending on the type of cadmium.
Really?
I think...
Are there any studies showing that cadmium or beryllium or barium or some of these others have adverse health impacts relating to the fluoride in water?
The problem is the entire medical community has been behind fluoridation for 50 years. There's little incentive to go back and prove 50 years of fist-pounding rhetoric wrong. And the people who do, the dentists and doctors, which actually, and there are many of them, which have come out and found adverse health effects related to fluoride, often pay a price of being ostracized. They lose their funding. And it's not because their science is incredible. It's because there is an incredible inertia riding behind us. You just had several people testify. Don't worry about the lead that goes into the water based on, as a result of fluoride. And yet, the very study one of the test presenters was referring to, this is the conclusion that's been echoed in numerous studies. There is no safe level of blood, because every little bit more you put in, it adversely affects children's IQ. And similarly, in arsenic, again, 1.66 parts per billion, which was the maximum they found related directly just to the addition of fluoride. 1.66 parts per billion sounds big until you realize that at a half a part per billion, based on, this is U.S. Data extrapolated from the largest study on arsenic done in 1999, even got stricter in their 2001 update, 1 in 10,000, an increased risk of cancer by 1 in 10,000. That's from a 0.5 parts per billion. At 1.66 parts per billion, it's going to go up somewhere between 1 in 1,000, 1 in 5,000 risk in cancer. That's not insignificant. Additionally, there's a couple other things that I think are important to look at. And some of these are, what about fluoride itself? We've been adding this stuff to the water for a long time. We certainly know that there's, whether it's cancer or Alzheimer's disease or ADHD in kids, we certainly know that there's a lot of human health ailments out there that are suspected to have, and some known to have, links to known chemicals, things that either occur naturally. I mean, mercury certainly occurs naturally. You drink from a mercury well, though, you're going to have a lot of problems. Same with lead and same with arsenic and same with fluoride. The fact that it occurs naturally is hardly an excuse to even worry about it. Here's an article in Brain Research. This is not left-wing quackery. This is a respected medical journal. Talks about chronic administration of aluminum fluoride or sodium fluoride to rats. What the study found was interesting. Previously, it was assumed that fluoride would not pass the blood-brain barrier. This study proved that wrong. And what it found is that fluoride actually caused the concentration of aluminum in the brain. Now, this is interesting because aluminum has been linked to a number of things such as Alzheimer's. Now, this study, published in 1997, to me, and not, again, the EPA researchers, respected PhDs, and the conclusion of it was that, this is surprising news. This is interesting. We know that aluminum has a lot of these problems. We now see that fluoride concentrates it. And this is the chemical. This is from Chemical and Engineering News. Again, we're not talking about anti-fluoride group here. Brain damage in rats from fluoridated water, and it goes on to explain that both treated groups suffered neural injury and showed increased deposits of beta amyloid. I'm going to not even say that right. Protein in the brain similar to those seen in humans with Alzheimer's. To me, how can you stand up here and say we absolutely know fluoride is safe when in 1997, not that many years ago, they found for the first time that fluoride itself, not just the contaminants, Similarly, another article, 1994, neurotoxicity of sodium fluoride in rats. What this found is at concentrate. Now, one thing that was interesting about the previous study is it was done at 2.1 parts per million, which is just about double what you get in the drinking water. This study used higher parts per million, 75 parts per million, 100 parts per million. Those are things a kid might get from swallowing toothpaste, but not at 1 point per million, one part per million in drinking water. But the effects of it and what the study found was what was really interesting. What it found was neurological effects that were comparable to hyperactivity when pregnant mothers consumed fluoride, specifically rats, consumed fluoride, their offspring had displayed things of hyperactivity. When it was consumed at these levels again by young rats, they also had things which the researchers said were prenatal exposure dispersed many behaviors as seen in drug-induced hyperactivity, while weaning and adult exposures led to behavior-specific changes more related to cognitive deficits. Again, we know lead does that. We know lead causes cognitive deficits. And again, this study is suggesting that fluoride itself might have some similar problems. So again, I'm going to leave it there. I think it's enough to say that before we go adding it to the water, and before we just assume, like many of the dentists and doctors I talked to, the last time they got into science on related to fluoride, it was when they were looking at their medical textbooks 20 years ago. They've assumed the same things are true ever since. Most have not read these studies, and I hope you will.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Bat and clean up here.
Okay. This is sort of deja vu all over again. The first time I testified in the legislature.
What's your name, please?
My name is Paul Craig Engelking, and I live at 32 North Alder Street in Lowell, Oregon.
Thank you.
I just mentioned that the first time I ever testified in the legislature was in about a Senate bill that was going to outlaw fluoride, chloride, bromide, and all the column of the periodic table. And the first time I ever testified as an expert at trial, I was cross-examined by an attorney named Ringo. I believe it was Charles Ringo. Is any relative of yours?
My dad is Robert Ringo.
Robert Ringo. I believe that was it. And it was in Benton County.
Was he nice to you?
He was actually very nice. Otherwise, I would have probably never come back.
Okay, good.
Yes.
That's lucky.
Well, thank you. Just for identification, I'm a professor of chemistry at the University of Oregon. I teach all levels of chemistry there from introductory general chemistry through graduate courses. I am currently teaching the third quarter of upper division physical chemistry. Did anyone want to learn some quantum mechanics right now? I wish to make it clear that I'm not speaking as an official representative of the state of Oregon, nor should my remarks be considered to be necessarily positions or policies of the University of Oregon or the state of Oregon or its agencies, unless specifically noted as such. I'm here now because my expertise gives me a uniquely informed perspective on the issue before you, which has allowed me to form an expert opinion. It is my opinion that going forward with HB 2025 in its current form would be injurious to aquatic organisms. My formal training includes Bachelor of Science degrees from California Institute of Technology, Physics, and Chemistry, a Master's, and then a Doctorate of Philosophy from Yale University, both in chemistry. I did postdoctoral work at JILA, jointly between the University of Colorado and the National Bureau of Standards, before joining the University of Oregon Department of Chemistry in 1977, where I became assistant professor and subsequently associate professor and then professor of chemistry. My research interest area involves spectroscopy, structure, reactivity, and detection of radicals and ions, originally in the gas phase and more recently in condensed phases.
We're willing to pass on your credentials here.
Thank you. Okay. I should mention that while I was doing this, I had totally forgotten that as a pickup study in the southern Willamette Valley area with a man named Gil Gaudia, a citizen who brought to my attention that reverse osmosis filters on his house were not effectively removing the arsenic from the water at his residence. We traced that back and found that RO filters did not remove arsenic from water, and we actually changed the National Sanitary Foundation recommendations that no longer recommend using a reverse osmosis for removing such a toxic element. So the reason I'm here today is mainly because water chemistry and the physical chemistry of fluoride. On top of everything, I and my students have measured fluoride content of many Oregon waters over the past 10 years. In conducting this work, I've become familiar with or at least read most of the original literature on the chemistry, detection, measurement, environmental effects, and toxicology of fluoride. To understand the effect of fluoride in the environment, one has to understand how fluoride affects with the environment. Fluoride can form complexes with other atoms or ions present. If ions such as calcium, magnesium, iron, or aluminum are present, fluoride ions form complexes with these, and the active chemical potential of fluoride is reduced. So other ions in water reduce the chemical activity of fluoride. Water hardness is a measure of this, and water hardness reduces the effect of fluoride ions. Other mechanisms that you need to understand to interpret fluoride toxicity in freshwater organisms is this. The concentration of salts in the plasma of freshwater organisms is thousands of times greater than in the surrounding water. A fish in the Mackenzie has chloride 3,500 times greater than in the surrounding freshwater. A trout maintains this concentration by pumping chloride ions from outside through gills and kidney membranes into its plasma inside. It must do this continuously, taking on its own body weight in water every 2.5 hours. Unfortunately for freshwater organisms, fluoride is also concentrated along with chloride. The ion pump that fish use, and in fact we use to concentrate chloride in our plasma, involves first transporting positive ions, potassium and sodium, and then the resulting positive potential draws up the negative ions through specialized ion channels.
Dr. Engelking, I mean, we've got your written testimony, and I guarantee you that I am going to read all this stuff, and I'm just wondering if you can really summarize what your analysis is.
Okay, the basic bottom line in this is that there are only two studies that are relevant to the very soft waters, low chloride content, low calcium magnesium content in Oregon. These are the Damkar and Day studies and the Newholt and Siegler studies on the toxicity. In the Damkar and Day studies, they found behavioral effects in fish of fluoride at 0.3 parts per million, that fish, salmon returning upstream, refused to go up the fish ladder through the structure.
That's the Damkar and Day study?
That's the Damkar and Day studies. People will say it took place on the Columbia. It actually was done as a controlled study at a research facility in Big Beef Creek. There was no question about other impurities. Sodium fluoride was used in that. The second study is the Newholt and Siegler that actually shows toxicity, lethal toxicity, at about 3 or 4 parts per million. The LD50 is about 3.9 parts per million. So, and in talking with other people who have reviewed these studies, toxicologists in this study, I've reviewed this with Larry Curtis at OSU, and also Gene Foster at DHS, and they agree that these studies are scientifically valid. They go through the Daubert test of the U.S. Supreme Court and would stand up. This is the only data we have for fish toxicity under the conditions of...
The Newholt and Siegler study, was that done in 1960?
Yes.
And when was the Damkar and Day study done?
Damkar and Day studies were done in the 80s. The end of the study, the physiological testing, the controlled study in Washington was done in, I believe, 87.
It seems to me the Newholt and Siegler study, relying on a study 45 years old, it's a pretty ancient analysis.
No one has done any other studies.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. Senator Atkinson, your questions? Okay, just another minute or so. So if you could just go ahead and conclude, that'd be great.
In my other hats that I've worn here, I've been on the city council of Lowell, and we've had arsenic in our water. And so I have looked at the arsenic problem in some detail. It had been stated here that because arsenic is undetectable, it would not have actual health effects. But actually, at the level at which arsenic would be added to the water as a result of the bringing it in with the hydrofluorosilic acid, that you would actually expect about 30 million bladder cancers and maybe about 120 million lung cancers in a population. Now, and Lowell only had a population of 1,000 or so, so it wouldn't be a big problem for us. But for a city the size of Portland, you would be looking at a significant arsenic loading as a result of fluoridation. So
we need to wrap up in just a minute, please.
That's it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. The hearing on House Bill 2025 is concluded. And just to those here on this issue, I invite further written information on either side and get it to me, get it to the members of the committee, and we'll take a look at it. So thank you very much. Let's open a public hearing on... first of all, who came from a distance on these bills? I see somebody from Sun River. Are you here? You came all the way to testify on this? Well, let's get you guys up here then. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2595. Bill Chapman, Mike Brannon. Is Representative Wiseman here? No. Why don't you two come on up here? How are things in Sun River these days?
Beautiful.
I'll bet that they are.
Well, my name is Bill Chapman. I'm the general manager of the Sun River Owners Association, and I do have a Robert Ringo story as well.
About my dad?
Your dad was my landlord in Corvallis when I first moved there. So,
what year was that?
That was in about 1975.
How did he treat you?
Very fine gentleman.
That's good.
Very fine gentleman. I lived in a little white house on 8th Street.
Is that right? Good, okay.
I want to introduce Mike Mike Brannon. Mike is the past president of the Owners Association, and he headed up a committee looking into how we might resolve a problem which occurred in the 2001 legislative session. So, Mike?
Okay, thank you very much. Chairman Ringo, my name is Mike Brannon. I'm a homeowner in Sun River, and as Bill said, former president of the Homeowners Association. The Sun River Owners Association functions as the governing body of Sun River, which is a 3,400-acre community of 4,200 homes with 1,500 year-round residents and over 10,000 daily visitors during the peak season. The association enforces community rules, administers planning and architectural control in cooperation with Deschutes County, maintains much of the community infrastructure, manages all commons of 1,300 acres, and represents the Sun River community to the wider world. For 17 years, SROA, which is Sun River Owners Association, has contracted with the Four Rivers Vector Control District to provide mosquito control in Sun River. And I might add, this is the only vector control within Deschutes County. There is none in anywhere else within the county, because this is the primary area in the county where there does exist a problem with mosquitoes. It's very marshy, as you might know. In the 2001 regular session, House Bill 2604 amended ORS Chapter 634, and the amendments restricted the ability of district employees to apply mosquito control materials outside their district boundaries. An exception was made for the application of pesticides to the properties of another governmental agency that was adjacent to them if the application met three-part pest tests contained in ORS 364.11.
Mr. Brannon, if I may just interject for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I think this bill makes sense.
Okay.
I think he does. Especially if Senator Westland testifies, that he may change their minds and then everybody makes them know. That happens all the time. So, I know we have some anxious committee members, and I apologize to you because I know you came a long ways to testify, but I think the sentiment of the committee is just to pass the bill.
Very well.
Is that fair?
That's fair to me.
Are you okay with
you
that?
You happy?
I think I can do that. I think
you're happy.
Okay. Are you okay with that, Terry? Okay, thumbs up. So is that okay?
That's fine. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Are you okay with that, Senator Westlund, or do you want to testify?
Absolutely not. I believe you're on the right path, and all I can do is deliver.
Okay. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2595. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2595.
Chair, move the House Bill 2595 to floor of the due pass recommendation. Senator Westlund is carried.
Senator Atkinson has moved that House Bill 2595 be moved to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation that Senator Westlund be the carrier. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you very much. Sure. I apologize to rush you, but thanks very much for coming all the way from Sun River.
Sure, they're thrilled. They came a little bit fast.
Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1044. Linda? Representative, wasn't it? You're too late. We passed this without your help.
Thank you, Senator.
Do you want to call Representative Barnhart?
Yeah.
Go call him. Yeah, let's do this next.
Senator Ringo, my name is Linda Swearingen. I'm from Deschutes County in Redmond, Oregon, and I'm here in regards to Senate Bill 1044. This is really a housekeeping bill that needs to be taken care of since periodic review is not available right now for counties on the west of the Cascades. Currently, the law says that if a county is interested in amending its destination resort overlay map, it has to do that in connection with periodic review. But as you know, periodic review has been put on hold for at least a period of 4 years, and it doesn't appear that counties are going to at least be part of that process in the future. And so this law would make a change, and it would make it exactly the same as the Eastern Oregon portion, which allows a county to amend its destination resort map overlay in 30-month planning periods, and a map adopted pursuant to this section shall be the sole basis for determining whether tracts of land are eligible for a destination resort. And
Linda, do you have written testimony on this?
No, I don't. In fact, I'm okay. The only other thing I want to tell you is Art Schlack from the Association of Oregon Counties was here. He had an emergency and had to leave, and they are, in fact, in support of this bill as right. well, because it does that.
Thank you. Where's LCDC on this bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and we support this amendment. I would make a minor correction that counties may use periodic review. The statute is actually we have amendments now before the House that would change periodic review. Generally, counties won't use periodic review. Some may opt for it, okay. but largely they won't use it.
Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Okay. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1044. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1044. There's no amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1044 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 1044 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2176. Who is in favor of this? Mike, are you coming up? Sarah.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Sarah Garrison. I'm the Capital Projects Division Manager for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. I know it's been a long day. I have submitted written testimony and a background sheet on the State Brownfield Redevelopment Fund, so I'll just make a couple points, and then if you have some questions, I can address those specifically. It's really a technical corrections bill to our current State Brownfield Redevelopment Fund. And the bill summary actually says that it eliminates a brownfield coordinator position. That is actually not the case. The department still retains all the responsibility in helping facilitate and fund brownfield redevelopment projects. It just isn't housed in a single person. As a matter of fact, the reality is that we have multiple staff that help deliver these services. And that's what we've changed the bill or the statute just to reflect the reality. The other thing that it changes is that all of the brownfield projects that we fund have to have oversight from the Department of Environmental Quality, and we would like to use part of the fund for administration costs to help offset those costs of the DEQ staff. The other thing that this bill does, as amended 2176A, is that it allows us to establish a fund to have money from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and establish a fund that we're calling the Oregon Coalition Brownfield Cleanup Fund.
And the theory is that would be available for federal money?
It is federal money, and we want to keep it separate from the other state-funded programs. And that's basically it.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Everybody, you want to think about this for a while?
Your pleasure, Mr. Chair. I'll vote it out today if you want to.
The Brownfields redevelopment program in Oregon would still go forward. It's just that it wouldn't be under one person without coordinating that.
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
And who would be responsible then for Brownfield redevelopment?
Mr. Chair, ultimately that would be myself as the division manager, and I do have a lead staff on it who really has in-depth expertise, but she actually does a lot of other things also.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions from the All right. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2176. Let's open a work session on House Bill 2176.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2176 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkins has moved House Bill 2176 to the floor with the due pass recommendations. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? No ordered. And now let's... you want to be a carrier, Senator Atkinson? Is that all right?
I want the last one, 1044. I'll carry them both.
Carry them both then. That'd be great. And then, so let's open...
But if I mention fluoride, I'm going to be a no vote.
They don't keep fluoride in propane tanks, as far as I know.
What about brownfields?
Let's open a...
brownfields?
Let's open a public hearing on House Bill 2328, Representative Barnhart and others. If you'd like to come up, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Phil Barnhart. I'm state representative from House District 11, Central Lane and Linn Counties. This bill comes to you unanimously from the House of Representatives, and it arises from a decision on the part of Lane County to start enforcing a law or an ordinance in the county that made propane tanks comply with land use law, which became very complicated and difficult. In spite of the fact that propane tank siting is regulated and has been regulated for many years by the state fire marshal. The result has been, in effect, has been either the imposition of very large fees and excessive planning requirements with a great expense to propane tank dealers and their clients, and also, or simply the discontinuation of the use of propane tanks or the installation of them. I have a bunch of concerns about that. Of course, several of them have to do with necessary regulation, whether this is a necessary regulation or not. I believe it's not. And also, of course, the convenience of individuals, the environmental impacts of the failure to continue to reduce the amount of wood burning that we do in our enclosed end of the valley, not least, of course, the impact this has on the small businesses that sell propane and that rent the tanks that residents use. The point of this bill is essentially to preempt portions of the county's authority in this area, essentially returning the authority where it belongs to the state fire marshal. There was no opposition in committee, nor on the floor in the House, as I indicated. I think I'll stop and let the experts talk, but if you have questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Okay, thank you very much. Is it Mr. Johnson?
Yes, I think, Monica, do you want
to go ahead?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you so much for hearing this bill. We appreciate it.
The Northwest Propane Gas Association asked for your support. I think Representative Barnhart did a great job of telling you what some of the effects have been of this little experiment in Lane County. What we've brought to you is a very surgical bill that tries to reflect what existing practice is, and I'm happy to go into the bill in more detail if you'd like.
I've looked at it. Thank you. Senator Byron, any questions? No, he's fine. Mr. Johnson, any...
I'm here to answer questions. Just that would point out that from my perspective as a land use practitioner, this is really kind of a maintenance bill. We're just trying to keep land use and not turn into something else.
Well, maybe we should just fix this in our Measure 37 rewrite.
This is about not land use, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other comments on this bill? Is there anybody else who wants to testify on this bill? Okay. Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2328. Open a work session on House Bill 2328.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2328 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved House Bill 2328 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered, and I will carry the bill. And this committee is adjourned until the Senate President says we're not.
No. Okay.